This is John Abrams, and this is The Variety Artist, episode 43. I began this whole variety arts magician journey when I was 29, a late bloomer by many standards. You can hear my entire story on episode 0 of The Variety Artist podcast. Give it a listen if you want to know how I got my start. Well, when I first started out, our guest today was already legendary. I'd seen him on TV and all over magic magazines. Here it is, 20 years later, and now you're going to find out why Nick became the guy he is today. Enjoy the interview. I surely did. Today's podcast is brought to you by Audible.com. They're offering you, The Variety Artist, a free audiobook download and 30-day free trial at thevarietyartist.com/book. Over 180,000 titles to choose from for your iPhone, Android, Kindle, or MP3 player. Just go to thevarietyartist.com/book right after this podcast and get your free audiobook. Now, let's start the show.
Welcome to The Variety Artist, providing aspiring artists and entertainers with in-depth discussions from top performers from all over the world. So get ready to book some gigs, make some money, and have some fun with your host, John Abrams.
My guest today is an international man of magic and master of sleight of hand. He recently completed a 5-year run in Las Vegas with his own award-winning one-man show. Variety Artist, I give you Nick Lewin.
Nice to be on the show, John. I think it definitely was a slightly lazy introduction because it's on my website, and it's been a while since I did that 5 years in Vegas. But
just opening this up, that's a great idea to put an introduction on your website. So before someone introduces you or when you book the show, they can just go to your website and take it off of that.
Oh, absolutely. And you can make sure it's short enough. I have that as a downloadable on my website, because otherwise you arrive and you find that they're not wanting to shortchange you on all your credits. They've got 3 pages written, starting with your high school production.
Yeah.
And someone's written that and given it to the head of the company, and he's determined to do it. So I have it on the website, then I have it on index cards, and then I give them ahead of time, and it has to be 2 sentences.
That's perfect. I was introduced one time years ago at a library with somebody that had a really boring voice, and they had, like you said, like 3 pages. I think he had like half a page, and he read it like this. And ladies and gentlemen, please welcome John Abrams. I'm like, hi, how are you?
Introductions are always so difficult. I remember once I was doing a corporate show in Arizona in Phoenix area, and it was for Circle K. They were in bankruptcy at the time, and this was their annual charity golf tournament. Mm. So it was a very, very controversial deal because all their big customers and clients and providers and suppliers were there because it was a charity event. And yet many of them were really upset because they hadn't got paid. That was not good. So in the introduction to the show, rather than my beautifully prepared little 2 sentences, the CEO of Circle came. There were a lot of tables that were just empty, you know, in protest to what was going on. He came up and he said, well, I'm looking around the room, and as I look around, I realize we probably owe money to every single person in this room. And mood of just... And I'm going, oh my God, did he really do this? And then he realized what a terrible mistake was. But he said, but I shouldn't have said that, should I? And it was a moment of psychoanalysis or might have, you know, jumped on. So then he read my introduction. I came out to the most brutal audience.
Oh, yeah.
So I immediately jumped around, switched the running order, and borrowed a $50 bill from the CEO who had done the introduction for a burnt and restored bill. And the moment I got it, I just looked at the audience and I said, well, I must be good because I guess I'm the only person in the room who can get any money out of this guy.
Oh, da-dum-bum.
The voice went crazy. The show went well. And at the end of it, the CEO came up and said, oh, thank God, he said. It was such a terrible mistake to say that. I didn't know what was going to happen. Thank you so much. And so introductions are, that's when the show starts.
You made it the perfect way to transition from a horrible introduction into something positive.
Wow. Okay. Well, good. I'll try and keep that mojo going.
Now, I also noticed on your website that you have downloadable photos and different things that if someone hires you, they can just go right to your website and download those, right?
Absolutely. They've got the photos they need. They've got the introduction. They do have a resume should they need it. They also have all my technical requirements.
Tell us kind of what you do for people that haven't heard of you, which I can't believe there is somebody out there that hasn't heard of you. But people that haven't heard of you, what exactly do you do?
Well, I'm a comedy magician. Well, that's what I've always done. I'm just count for 49 years making a full-time living doing this. Over those years, I've done a lot of other things. I've worked on ships a lot. I started that 48 years I worked on ships. I actually gave up, stopped this year. I decided I didn't want to do any more international travel. Airports are just getting worse and worse. But I did a lot of other stuff. I came out from England. I studied with Ken Brook. He was my mentor, who was a wonderful mentor, who trained me to really become a magician. He didn't train me to do magic, or he didn't try and sell me tricks from his magic store. He actually taught me his act. Bit by bit, and I would go and I'd learn it. Of course, Paul Daniels was at the same time learning from him. And Paul, when I knew him back in those days, was still in charge of doing the accounts for the grocery store in the family. He would travel down from the north of England, and I'd come down from Brighton, and Ken would spend a full day. So I was very lucky on that. And then Billy McComb became a huge influence and then my second mentor. By the time when I was 21, I moved out, went to the castle, worked there for about a decade, had a wonderful time close up.
Did you live here in LA?
Oh, absolutely. I lived in LA for till about 86.
What made you decide to go from London to LA?
Well, my wife is Californian. I'd been traveling around, and to be honest, there wasn't a lot of work in England in those days. Everybody did every kind of gig, and like most people, I started off with kids' parties and things like that. And you do like four or five a day in the season. Everybody was competing with everybody. Billy McComb would happily be out doing a kids' show if it was a good one, or Ali Bongo. So you were competing with an amazing group of people. It wasn't that easy as a 21-year-old. That's why I started working on ships, because it was a good line of work for me. I got out of England, I saw the world, and was able to really perfect my magic and get my magical chops together doing a regular gig.
By the way, anybody who's not a magician that's listening to this, all these are big names. So at 21 years old, or before you were 21 years old, you were working with Billy McComb and Ali Bongo, and Ken Brook, of course, was your mentor. So it was all before you were 21?
Absolutely. I knew them all very well. But my very first show at the castle, Don Lawton was hosting, and I was 21. I was pretty nervous being at the castle. Don Lawton popped his head backstage and said, "Well, do you want to know who's in the house tonight?" And I said, "Well, I don't know." He said, "Oh, I think you do." And Cary Grant was sitting with David Niven on one side of the room.
Oh, my.
Ingrid Bergman was sitting on the other side of the room. And not important enough to get a seat, Goldie Hawn was standing with a group at the back of the theater. That was my introduction to working at the castle. It was a lot of fun. And so I did a lot of that. And I got to do a lot of TV work back in the 70s, 80s. I was on Amazing Stories for Steven Spielberg, Misfits of Science, Dynasty. I had a great episode written for me, in fact, on Alfred Hitchcock Presents, a Houdini episode where I got to die and come back.
How did you get those TV spots? Was it through an agent, or did somebody see you, or how did that come about?
A little bit of each. I certainly used the castle to promote people coming to see me, but I kind of lucked out. I did obviously have agents. I was with ICM for a while, who were one of the big three, though I don't think it really helped me on those. A lot of that TV work just sort of happened. And in those days, somebody would call in and want something from the castle. And they'd say, oh, we need a magician to do this or that. And it acted as an unofficial little booking center.
When you were working at the castle, people would come and see you and book you through that?
Oh, yeah, that certainly happened. But, you know, we worked everything pretty hard. We really worked mailing lists, mailings. You know, you just have to really hustle and bustle just to get to people to know who you are. I always had great photos. You got to have new and fresh photos. And if you have a photo that doesn't make you look like a magician, then you might get a role where you're not a magician. But if you've got something where you've got, you know, a rabbit in a hat or a flash wallet or something, well, hey, they're going to put you up for all those magician roles.
Right.
There's nothing wrong with that. I did that in Perfect Strangers and shows like that. You know, the nice part, you'd still get residuals. I just got a check 2 days ago for Dynasty.
Oh, is that right?
$2.60.
It cost them more to send it out, probably.
Absolutely. So those were great days. And then I discovered the comedy club market.
Now, when you were doing comedy clubs, I saw one of your comedy videos and you open with a magic trick and you close with a magic trick. And then the rest is straight comedy. Is that how you structured those?
Well, actually, no. That would be how I would have edited the video. I'm a great believer in editing the video for what you want the video to do. A lot of people, performers, try very hard to reproduce in that 3 minutes or whatever you've got, 2 minutes of video time. They try and keep everything in the same order and structure that they have in their actual show. And I don't find that works as well. I think you have to really look on it as a trailer. When I actually did comedy clubs, I co-headlined twice, and I hated it the second time so much, I said, I'll never do that again.
Why is that?
Well, there was a lot of pressure and flipping bills. And that's the first time was great. I worked with Bruce Baum, who was baby man to the kids out there in the audience. And we had a wonderful week. The second time, not so much. So I said, well, I'm already there. I can go off and work on ships and make as much money as this. So, you know, I'm just going to do it my way. And there was always a tendency to want to put the magician in the middle of the show. Right. A, because he was a variety act and he would split it up. Kind of like they do the same with female comedian. They're not particularly imaginative, these club owners, for the most part.
It seems to be the woman or the magician is like the token woman, the token magician.
Exactly. So I was lucky. I just headlined, but the first thing you had to do, a lot of magicians, of course, whenever a new source of work opens up, everyone's itching to do it. So the moment the comedy clubs really began to expand, a lot of magicians wanted to jump into it. And they got in trouble because the definition of comedy to comedians and comedy to comedy magicians is a very, very different one.
How so?
Well, because comedians really expect everything to be original, one-off. They, you know, their code of ethics, people do not steal material and live. And they certainly, the stock lines, people would come out from the magic world who would have a trick and it would be cobbled together with a bunch of, you know, Robert Orban type zingers, lines and things like that. And that just did not work in a comedy club at all. It was just not what they did, but they could get away with it in the middle role. So what I used to do, I used to start off with 15 minutes of just stand-up comedy. Mm. Because if I was following two other comedy acts, the first thing I had to do was establish my credentials that I was as funny as they were. In fact, funnier because I was the one who was closing the show. Huh. I was doing comedy clubs very early, and the only guys who were other magicians who were really headlining at that exact point, at least in the very earliest days, it was Amazing Jonathan and Kozak, and Finney, and John Farentino. You know, I know I'm missing people off that list, but that was the first wave. And you had to be really funny. I mean, I followed Ray Romano, people like that. And believe me, they were funny before they were TV stars.
Oh, yeah. That's the way they got their TV shows. That's
exactly right. So that's the way I did it. I did it head on in. I didn't want it to look like the magic was a crutch.
Right.
I wanted it to be a nice bonus that you came in with at the end.
Mm.
Most of this I've now totally abandoned because the comedy club market is not something I will ever do again. But for 11 years, it was what I did.
Since we're talking about structuring videos and structuring your comedy, let's talk about structuring a show. When you're starting to structure a show, what is it that you start to put together? How do you structure a show?
I grew up in a pre-digital era, and it definitely gave me an analog frame of mind to structuring a show. Everything I had was written on index cards, and they were color-coded, and they were inside a box, and I would have a list of the tricks that were openers, middles, closers, card tricks, needed assistance on stage, could be done close up, needed a theater, whatever it was, they were all coded on each card.
Okay.
And then on the back of that, I just wrote down each prop that was needed. So when it came time, if I was putting a show together, I would be able to say, oh, yep, I need a ring, a bit of rope, I need this, that, and it was all done. So nice. For me, those early days, it was very much weighing up and making lists from those cards. Sometimes you spend 20 minutes making a list, find you'd only made one tiny change, but it was the key change you needed. Now, of course, I do that on the computer now, and I use programs like Drafts and Notes and everything. I do sometimes wonder if it wasn't a truly wonderful training to have done it in such an analog manner. You really got the feeling of those as being separate routines combining.
That's a smart way of doing it. I mean, even if you do it digitally now, putting the routine on a card or digitally, you know, and then putting all the props on the back and then being able to just take the cards and put them in order and making your set list.
Well, that's it. You can really do that. And the nice part being once you've done that for a show, you just keep track of what you used for that show. And then if they book you again, you know what you did, what you didn't do, and what went well, what didn't. So I was always pretty technical. But I think in structuring a show, I do have a background, although I always perform magic. I did perform it, work my way through drama school, theater school, got a degree in theater.
Mm-hmm.
I think the only thing I really came away from with it that it really left imprinted on my mind was the three-act format.
Oh, yeah.
And the three-act format is very important. And I've always used that as a structural basis in what I'm doing. But when I'm actually structuring a show, I think you have to begin with that very first appearance on stage. The structure is involved in that. I remember talking to Billy McComb once, and when he was first playing the London Palladium and was very excited and overawed by it, there was some old comic on the bill. And Billy was just amazed because every night he would walk up, his music would play, and boom, he arrived at the microphone, the music stopped, and he was into the show. Then Billy discovered that he counted every step. So everything was done. He knew to the step how long it would take him to get there. It was tied in with his music. And so he always started the show at exactly where he wanted to be. And that, I think, is what structure is about. You have to decide what that first look that they take at you is going to be very, very important. I mean, are you dressed funny? I mean, if you come out dressed like Matt King, you've got entire audience thought going. If you come out dressed like Penn and Teller, you've got another. And neither of those are particularly accurate. You know, they're just the costumes worn. So you do have that thing when you walk out.
So your opening establishes, here I am, comedy magician.
Exactly. You've got to walk out. You've got to have that smile on your face. If I'm not talking about coming out doing comedy, that's another thing. You come out, you do a great comedy routine that's topical, fresh, original. Well, that was a great way to start in the comedy clubs because of that locale. It's not what I would have done on the ships or what I would do in a corporate setting. I would come out and I would do a trick that was just there to keep eye contact with the audience. And I think the most important item, that first trick that you're doing, is you have to make eye contact with the audience and you have to keep your eyes moving around. So you're looking from side to side in the audience, to the back, to the front, even places where you're not seeing anybody, you may be totally blinded by light. I'm a great believer in knowing how big the theater is, and if at all possible, getting out there and being able to estimate that, where I need to look to cover that. So my first trick is always something that allows me not to have to look at my hands. So that was my structure, always included getting to know the audience a little bit up front in terms of eye contact and letting them see what you do. You don't want to waste your best trick up front. You want to do something that's going to help you. And I very often would take a trick. I don't like to call them sucker tricks or anything like that, right, because they're not. But that kind of spot card, color change silk, something like that, to me is a great trick because you're starting to explain it, but then you're doubling back and fooling them again. For me, both of those tricks have been very useful over the years because they've helped me actually train the audience a little bit in when I want them to laugh, when I want them not to, to stop them, to start them. This commonly, very much a I'm the boss here thing going on in a good-natured way, because it's never too early to take charge of the show.
Yeah, so far, from what you've explained, you've established kind of your character, whatever it may be, whether it's serious illusion or comedy. You've gotten everybody as part of the audience because you've done eye contact with the people in the front row, people in the back row, right, left, all over the place. And you've started with a routine that gets them involved, maybe what we call a sucker routine, to a routine that gets them involved so they're part of the action too. That's all within the first couple of minutes.
That's exactly right. I would normally do a block of comedy there so they know a little bit more about me. I'm often amazed that very, very disciplined magicians, I watch them performing, and they look like they haven't thought for 30 seconds about the actual words they're going to use between To me, the most important part of structure, if we're talking about this generally, is the mortar that you use between the bricks of material. And Ken Brook always used to talk about this as being linkage. The linkage that you have that takes you from one place to another. And when you observe a performer, a magician, who hasn't had the opportunity to work a great many shows frequently, there's a little gap between tricks that they're doing. One trick ends and another one begins. Now, a lot of the pros, and from certainly the ones coming from the comedy club era, everything had to move from one thing to another very, very quickly. Unless you wanted the audience to realize you were going from one style of thing to another style of thing, there shouldn't really be a gap at all. It should never be just look like you've just finished one trick and you're starting another. That in-between time is what, you know, sorts out the men from the boys in that field.
Yeah, one of the great techniques, or I think anyway, of putting together a magic show is once you put something together, you find that there are little bits and pieces that aren't as strong as other bits and pieces, and you take out those lesser bits and pieces.
Absolutely, and that structure is very largely how you take care of those things that hold up the structure. And a lot of that is putting something in, trying it, taking it out. And very often you do a trick, and the first time you do it, it works great. The second time it doesn't work at all well because you had all that excitement and the energy and going into it the first time you did it. So the work begins from the second time onwards. But when you've spent a lot of time working with comedians, you notice that they never ever stop editing their material. And they're always making it tighter. If you say three lines between the tricks, if you can cut that down to two lines, you've improved your show. in all probability, because that third line was probably unnecessary and you were just kind of waffling. One of my favorite Oscar Wilde stories was he met an old friend when they were having dinner at the Cafe Royal, and his friend said, "Oscar, you look exhausted. What's the matter, dear man?" Oscar Wilde said, "I'm just exhausted. I'm devastated. I've worked so hard today. I'm working on a new play, and I worked on it all morning, and I put a comma in. Then I had a little lunch. There's not I worked on it again, and I took the comma out. I'm exhausted." And it's kind of like that. You put the comma in, you take the comma out. But in terms of structuring the act, I think the things you have to look at is to make sure that all your tricks are different. And that's a very basic statement. And I see Magic Club shows where people come out and they do three or four variations of the same trick in a row without ever really fully realizing that they're repeating themselves. Or you see somebody come out and do four or five tricks in a row that require taking people up from the audience and bringing somebody on stage. Well, there's a repetition going on there, and the show is incorrectly structured, because there's plenty of times it might be more effective for you to walk into the audience, which I frequently do in my show. I like to come down into the audience, break that fourth wall, and some of the magic can be done extremely well if it's correctly lit from the audience, and people are right there, they're right around you. I think that's something that's important. And I'm a big believer in having your strongest effect second from last. Mm-hmm. One that you think you should probably close on, you should just put one other thing. I close my show, and have done for about 35 years now, on a slow motion torn and restored newspaper routine, which is basically the Alex Elmsley trick. But I just love it, and I close with it, and I get standing ovations because the role of that final trick is to get applause and a standing ovation, because that's how you get rebookings. If you get a booking, the moment you walk on stage, your next job is to get a rebooking or another engagement from it. So you have to maximize all those moments. To me, I mean, on a personal level, I liked, even when I was doing the Illusion show, I still ended up with just me and that newspaper on stage. It was still the perfect illusion, because they saw it blend together, and it eliminated any props, assistance, or anything else. So to me, it was building up to a big ending. It was making it a very sleek, powerful ending.
And you suggested that you do your big closer second to last trick?
There are some things that just almost don't need to be said, but I will. I think the theory that you should be alone on stage at the end of that final piece of magic is very, very important. And if you're left with two people on stage with you, it had better be a damn good trick.
Yeah, I agree with you.
The applause is going to dwindle by the time that, you know, that it's out of your hands and out of your control. So for me, I would do, say, maybe do the bottles, and that was the natural finish. I had a big Union Jack coming down from the table, the James Bond themes playing. They were really ready to go. And just as they were, I stopped them at the height of their applause, or before they stand up on the ship, and say, "No, I want to do one more thing." Boom, and you're that one extra thing. And then do the newspaper. So I would kind of have my cake and eat it. I would do a very set final piece, but then I would tag on a signature piece, a trademark piece after that. I think it's important that you actually at some point in your show create an emotional moment, and it doesn't have to be a lot. What they really want to do is they want a little bit of emotion that is genuine and comes from you. And they would like to have a little spark about who you really are and why you're doing what you do. Because lay people out in the audience, they're kind of interested in why anyone would be a magician. And, you know, you have to go a tad below the, well, I saw Houdini, I saw the movie when I was a kid, or I got a magic set. Well, those are all the standard answers, and people can guess at most of that. But what they don't guess is what part of your personality or what it is that makes it special for you. And in sharing that with the audience, you're giving them an access to a part of yourself that is important.
In every one of my shows, I tell a personal story. And it's a personal story. It gets the audience to get to know me a little better, gets to know my personality. And that actually propels your character more in the show.
It does. And people are interested in the magic you do. They're interested, though not deeply interested, in why you do it. If you can give them a nice, quirky little thing. I do the gypsy yarn. In my case, it's a bigger piece. And the use of the music and the storyline within it. I really created something that was important and real to me. But then I disguised it a bit and twisted it around a bit. But I'm still left with a genuine emotion with it. The music brings that up. And that's enough. That's a 3-minute bit. And in 50 minutes in a show, you don't need to make them think that you're the world's most fascinating human being or that you understand psychological NLP things and can really almost read their minds. Well, that's all extraneous. As long as you go up there, you do a good show, they enjoy it, and you get great applause at the end, you've really done your job.
It's always smartest, I think, to be honest in your presentation. When I first started doing this years ago, I do magic with live animals. I would be like big game hunter guy. That was kind of my character when I first started doing it. And then as I did it year after year, I realized that the audience, they didn't want that. They didn't want to somebody that they couldn't relate to. So as I was telling more personal stories and the audience was getting to know me personally better, my shows became much better and much more honest to myself and to the audience.
Exactly. But one of the things that I'm enjoying doing now, I'm winding down a lot of all the international travel I was doing, is I've actually released the 2 1-hour shows that have really made me my living over the years. I've done this in the course of the last 7 years, and I now have got 22 signature items out. But the interesting part, well, I thought that would be fun, but now I'm starting to enjoy working with people who want to actually connect them up. They want to know how those hunks connect one bit to another. What's the pullback from there to there? Why wouldn't you do that in the same show as the other? And I'm starting to find that I'm quite intrigued working with what people's personality is and suggesting, well, I'll take this hunk there now. I've done all the heavy lifting. Now make it your own.
Now we're going to talk in a couple minutes about Loon Enterprises, all your products that you're talking about, all your personal effects. But before we do that, let's do fact or something John just made up. Sound like fun?
Oh, yes.
Is it fact? Or is it something John just made up?
So here's how it works. I'm going to read a headline, and you're going to tell me whether it's true or not. And if it is true, tell me a little story about it.
Okay.
You ready?
You bet.
After his famous multiplying bottle routine, the ship's captain asked to drink from one of the bottles. Nick did a quick bottle switch and made it happen.
Wow, that was that. I was thinking on my feet that day.
Is that true?
Totally untrue. I did once have a captain who was Norwegian who wanted to introduce me. I was doing close-up magic after the show, and he introduced me to Aquavit, which is just a disgustingly powerful drink. And so we were doing shots of Aquavit. Then I had to do another trick. So obviously the idea was with all these burly Norwegian sailors, you know, this little British kid would get so drunk he'd screw up all the magic. So
oh, no.
I realized this was... So then what I did using those magical skills, every time they filled up the shot glass, I would like go downwards, it would actually all go on the floor, then I would fly up to my mouth, and then I'd look like I was drinking it, and sometimes I'd leave a little half glass full or whatever, you know. And so I'm sitting in a pool of aquavit on the floor, and eventually the captain was so drunk, well, I think I have to go back to the bridge. They require my presence.
Wait, I've been drinking all night. I think I'll go and drive a giant ship. What a great idea.
Yeah, he was going right to his bunk, but he wasn't going to admit defeat. So that's the closest to that story that we could come.
Next headline. Nick once used Melanie Griffith as an audience volunteer and never realized who she was.
No, that's not true, but it would be fun. The truthful one on that, I did little variations on this theme. I once used Lou Ferrigno and didn't know who the hell he was. It was a Hollywood fundraiser, and it's the last time I've used a really bad stock put-down line in my life. I was very young. The Incredible Hulk was a big show, and I was working this audience. They just would not shut up. They were so noisy, and I'm trying to do something, talk to somebody in the audience. I had no idea it was Lou Ferrigno.
Oh.
I used the old line, "Can't you follow me? Read my lips," which is probably the most embarrassing moment of my career to have said that to someone.
Tell us why that is embarrassing.
He is deaf. Cannot hear, and his communication skills were just the most awful thing you could do. So I've never used one of those Robert Orban zingers since. I've gone, no, it's not for me.
Oh, boy. All right, last one. Nick once performed with Nelson Riddle and a 42-piece orchestra and arrived with 12 band parts.
True, I finally come to the true story.
Hooray!
There you go. It was an event for the returning POWs, and Ronald Reagan was there, and it was a great build, 42-piece Nelson Riddle organ. I'm a huge Nelson Riddle fan. Immediately prior to me on the bill was Sammy Davis Jr., who had to go on early because he was in a play at the Schubert in town. And then some bright spark had said, well, let's put a magician on the bill. He did his set, and then somebody had to fill in before Tony Bennett. And Tony Bennett was closing out the thing. So I got to be, you know, to follow. It was just fairly overwhelming. And I was probably 22 at the time. Thank God I had the ego you have at that age. But I went in for the rehearsal. I've never seen so many instruments in my life. I couldn't have named most of them. And Nelson Riddle sitting at the piano. And I arrived in, and I had 12 band parts written on a cruise ship. And I probably never heard at least four of these parts. You know, I've never heard the trombone part or anything. But I had this little collection of music. And I said, well, Mr. Riddle. And he said, oh, call me Nelson. I said, well, sir. I said, no, call me now. Well, okay, Mr. Real. I couldn't get it right. I said, you know, I don't think these are going to cut it for the full orchestra. And he said, well, do you want to leave it with me, Nick? And I said, yes, sir. And he said, it's just a play on. I said, okay. So I went, and that evening I was waiting backstage. Sammy Davis was, as always, wonderful. He finished, and then the introduction was coming up, and I realized I had no idea what music I was walking out to or anything. And it was the summer that Star Wars came out, whatever year that was. Nelson Riddle, my pal Nelson,
yeah,
that's the story now gets to be,
yeah, your buddy.
It's all better over the years. Played the theme, the fanfare from Star Wars. Every instrument, there was timpani going, harps. He was racing up and down the piano, and I just stood in the wings. And I heard this music out front, and I kind of like snapped to, walked out on stage and went out and did my set. And to this day, it's probably the most exciting thing I've ever done.
So Nelson Riddle's band playing orchestra playing the Star Wars theme.
That was it. It doesn't get better than that.
And performing between Sammy Davis Jr. and Tony Bennett.
Oh, yeah. I mean, you know, on its own, that's a trip all its own.
What else do you want in life?
I guess there's been a few other highlights, but that was still a big one.
That was Fact. Or something John just made up.
All right, so Nick, tell me about Lewin Enterprises, your different product line.
It's we've been going about, as I say, about 7 years. I wanted to actually take all the routines I made a living with, all my signature pieces, and to do them correctly. I'm performing less and less these days, and I wanted to make sure that my work was really preserved in some form. And I really enjoyed it. Making the DVDs, I'm a bit of a detail freak. I mean, I can spend 15 minutes telling you how to put the silk inside a dye tube. When you've learned it, you go, wow, my God, I'll never do it another way. But not everybody likes to be that detailed. So with this product line, we wanted to sell routines, not just tricks. More and more, the emphasis seems to be on just a trick, and people are buying, you know, little downloads just to satisfy the itch of knowing how it's done. We wanted to create a company with products that were really for workers. And I mean, people who went out there and actually performed for lay people. That's what we've done.
How can they get a hold of your products?
Well, that's easy. It is Lewin Enterprises, LewinEnterprises, LewinEnterprises.com. I've also got a blog, RemarkableMagic.com. I've been writing for about 10 years. Again, it was very important to me to get down some personal stories about some of the people I've been lucky enough to know in magic, some of the famous ones and some of the not famous ones, and some of the things I've learned from them. So I do have that blog that people might enjoy.
And tell us the name of that again.
That's RemarkableMagic.com.
Can you tell us, you've been doing this for years and years, a performer horror story, something crazy that happened?
I don't dwell on them. I've had almost everything that can go wrong, but to be honest, I really enjoy it. I mean, to me, when something goes wrong, it's just a wonderful chance to get you thinking on your feet. I've turned some near disasters into absolute triumphs, because there's nothing the audience likes better than if it looks like something has gone really wrong. And if you just readjust what you're doing, you can turn it into a wonderful audience moment.
I was talking to my daughter just about this exact subject yesterday, and we were talking about how when the magician or the performer, whatever he may be, makes a mistake or appears to make a mistake, the audience says, oh my gosh, and they're sucked in even more. And then if you can make lemonade out of lemons, if you can pull yourself out of that, the audience appreciates it. And they're brought into a moment that is real.
Well, that's exactly right. That's the impromptu moment. You have to be very careful not to make magic. And everything I say about magic, I mean, I have worked for years with other variety acts. A magician is just one form of a variety artist. And we have those same guidelines, whether you're a juggler, ventriloquist. But everything I've said, I really believe goes for anybody in any of those professions. I don't think it changes. Our job as a variety act is to produce variety in the show. So therefore, we must be doing something a little bit different from what anyone else is doing.
All right, well, give us one piece of advice for the beginner.
Okay, a piece of advice for the beginner is to keep practicing. It's the old cliched saying, and I'm going to say it again because it's so true, is an amateur practices till he can get something right, and professional practices until he can't do it wrong. You have to just keep doing shows. There is absolutely no substitute for doing shows. You can tape yourself in your living room as much as you like and put stuff on YouTube all you want, but it's when you're actually there with an audience that there is a synergy and a symbiotic relationship between the performer and the audience that turns it into something special.
All right, how about some advice for the working pro?
Advice for the working pro: be realistic about your fees and never badmouth another act, because it'll come back to bite you, and just keep performing.
All right, well, I'm going to ask for a recommended book and let you go. I've taken enough of your time. Do you have a book to recommend for us?
I do. It's a two-part recommendation. If you want to do comedy magic, and that's what I feel best able to describe, McCombs 25 Years Wiser is a wonderful book that gives you an understanding of what goes on in comedy magic. And there's some parts of it there, even half pages, if you look at them carefully, they're going to be able to totally open up your mind to different things that you could be doing in the business. Mind-blowingly well written. So that's number one. But the best one, I think, is Ron Wilson's The Uncanny Scot. I think anybody, if you wanted to make a living performing magic in this day and age, if you just had that one book and you studied that one book, I think you would be able to come away with a repertoire of material that was so good that you would never need another trick.
Wow.
And if you're thinking about cruise ships, you might want to look at my book. I've got a book, Cruise Magic 101, How to Make a Great Living on a Cruise Ship, Performing Magic. I can tell you, I think I put everything into that book. If anyone's interested in that specific area, they might enjoy that book.
And they can get that at lewinenterprises.com?
And it's just a brief book, but it tells you how to, again, goes through the structure, how to contact the agent or the shipping line, what they're going to want, what to expect, what they're not going to expect. It would actually be of interest to almost any variety performer.
All right, well, thanks, Nick, for doing my show. That was fun.
It's a pleasure. Thank you for having the show. It's great. I wish there'd been a show like this when I was in my early years, and it's just great to be part of it. And I'm delighted that you're doing such a wonderful job and bringing information to so many people.
Well, thanks. That's one of the reasons that I'm doing it. I wish I had this when I was starting out, too.
Well, it's important. And, you know, for me to sit here and talk and, you know, spill out a bit of information, it is great to know it's going out. Everybody in this business rests on the shoulders of those around them, before them. We need to get rid of the competition, get ourselves back into a community. And that's what you do with this.
Oh, thanks. Thanks. I enjoy it. I love it. Do you want to promote any other social media or anything else?
Well, I'm on Twitter, Nick Lewin 1, Instagram, Nick Lewin 8888. There must be a lot of Nick Lewins out there. I discovered it later on. But mostly I would say check out if you've enjoyed the stories, check out the blog site and remarkablemagic.com. There's some great stories and video and stuff on that. And that also does link you into this site if you specifically want to buy material. And don't be afraid to phone up and ask me what I think.
Thank you, sir. I'll put all those notes on your show notes page so someone can just go to your show notes page and click on one of those links, read your blog, get one of your products, whatever. And thanks to all my variety artists. If you found this podcast valuable, share it with your friends or on your social media. That's how we can create an entire variety artist revolution. You can reach me at my email at john@thevarietyartist.com or join my Facebook group at The Variety Artist, where you can ask me to ask questions of our guests. Now go out and book those gigs, make some money, and have some fun.
That's all for this episode of The Variety Artist, but your journey continues on our website. Go to thevarietyartist.com for more strategies, insight, and resources, as well as show notes on today's guest to assist you in your career. We'll see you on the next episode of The Variety Artist. But until then, go out and book those gigs, make some money, and have some fun.